probably tell us his own name.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now, the topic I've been given was not of my choosing, and it's kind of embarrassing. I'm supposed to talk about myself and the outreach that supposedly I'm doing in Australia and New Zealand. And then others have told me, illustrious senior personalities connected to your glorious community have told me, just talk about whatever you want to talk about. So, suffering from middle mania, I always try to find the middle path on anything. Trying to think of a way that I can avoid talking about what I do while at the same time presenting some insights. If any of you were at the ILS in Mayapur this year, you might have heard a seminar that I gave called Crisis in First World ISKCON. So, let us begin with some shastra. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, during the discussion between Ramananda Roy and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we are presented with the all-attractiveness of Krishna for all kinds of devotees. You know the first verse in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Akila Rasamrita Murti. Krishna has something for all devotees. All devotees can be attracted to Krishna. Kaviraj Goswami establishes that point and then goes on to explain that not only does Krishna attract all devotees, but Krishna attracts even himself. And he gives evidence how Mahavishnu, in his portion of the spiritual world, schemed to see Krishna accompanied by Arjuna. Why? Srila Prabhupada explains that Mahavishnu was attracted to the bodily features of Krishna. And of course, Lord Narayan is attracted to Krishna. His consort, Lakshmi Devi, is attracted to Krishna. The Nagapatnis testify to that. How is it that this Kaliya serpent receives such benefits? Benefits that Lakshmi Devi performed so many austerities to try and get. But why simply Narayan? Why simply Mahavishnu? Why simply Lakshmi Devi? Krishna himself, Rupa Goswami explains, seeing a reflection of himself on a pillar in Dwarka, wondered, why is my mind so attracted to this form I'm seeing? My mind is demanding that I embrace this form, just as Srimati Radharani desires to embrace this form. The all-attractiveness of Krishna is not simply an esoteric point to be realized when one is situated in his or her constitutional position. That point is there in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that all rasas find their completion in Krishna. All five. Besides the Srup City, approaches to the Srup City, Krishna's all attractiveness is crucially important for our outreach. We need to keep in sight the all attractiveness of Krishna if we're going to be effective in our outreach, effective in our compassionate activities. I heard Srila Prabhupada explain once a very interesting definition of management. He said, management means to create an attraction for Krishna where there is none. That is management. In other words, people say, who is Krishna? Why should I be interested? Management organization means to stimulate interest, attraction in Krishna among persons who think they have no attraction for Krishna. That is management, that is organization. Another point raised in a purport in Madhya Lila, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada points out that this Krishna consciousness network, I prefer not to use the word movement, it sounds too 60-ish to me. I like network, global network. You know, the peace movement, the civil rights movement, that was, you know, another yuga. But in any case, This Krishna consciousness movement is meant to attract all types of persons, even those who think they have no spiritual interest in Krishna or who have material reasons for approaching Krishna. So this is our boldness. This is our all-inclusiveness. We don't expect that we're going to deal with persons who immediately express an attraction for Krishna. We don't expect to deal with persons who have only pure motivation in approaching Krishna. Srila Prabhupada then went on to explain that in the association of devotees, the motivations and the persons become purified. So on the one hand, we're outrageous, outgoing. In other words, we're prepared to deal with persons whether they feel attracted to Krishna or not. And we're prepared to deal with persons whether they have a pure spiritual desire to serve Krishna or not. And on the other hand, we're meant to have an establishment, a setup, some kind of facility so that desires can be purified, motivations can be purified, attraction for Krishna can be aroused. Because some persons are coming to Krishna not with material desires, but no attraction. Somehow they cross our path and they have no conscious attraction for Krishna. But yet we're meant to be set up to deal with them as well as those who approach Krishna but with material desires. So this was Srila Prabhupada's confidence that in the right setup with the right kind of persons, anyone can become purified of their material motivations, or anyone can become conscious of their dormant attraction for Krishna. All right, now let's focus on some current sociological realities. I can tell you from one vantage point I have on the world, and I get to see every part of the world except Antarctica. There's just scientists there and military personnel. But for the past 20 years or so, I've traveled extensively on every habitable continent of the world. So I have GBC, allergies, sorry. I have GBC responsibilities in Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. I've retired from GBC responsibilities in South America and Russia. And I also have GBC responsibilities in Gita Nagari. One of those locations gives a unique vantage point. That's New Zealand. Way down under. Interesting. Interesting sidelight. We all know that there seems to be a world crisis in Ukraine. Suddenly Ukraine has emerged on the global radar. In ISKCON, Ukraine is famous because it's the site of the biggest festival in ISKCON. Last year, 13,000 devotees. I remember mentioning to His Holiness Narendra Maharaj about 2 years ago, this festival is getting so big, there's no doubt that there are going to be some geopolitical upheavals. Because the former Soviet bloc is not a part of the world, even though ISKCON is, relatively speaking, booming there, it's not a part of the world where Maya just sits back and says, have a good time, just spread Krishna consciousness, I won't bother you. some of you may know that during the 80s, I spent many years behind the former Iron Curtain. And the greatest agony there was, as soon as you get something good going, as soon as there seems to be some progress, smash. It's like Maya saying, "What are you doing in my backyard?" We're talking about geography because one Princeton scholar just did a study, a sample study of the American population, and found out that 1 out of 6 Americans have no idea where is Ukraine. And the ones who are most militant in saying the U.S. should intervene and do something, they are the ones who don't know where Ukraine is. So, anyway, in case you don't know where New Zealand is, it's most Americans think it's right next to Australia, but actually it's a 4-hour flight from Australia. And below New Zealand is just the ocean, and then far away is the South Pole. But there are so many tourists there from all around the world, and students from all around the world. So in that way, it does give you a window. Sometimes when I do programs in New Zealand, outreach programs at our Bhakti lounges, I can see that the audience is 80% American students. And you know what question I asked them? What do you think I asked them? Huh?
Have you ever been to a temple?
No, I don't ask them, have you ever been to a temple? I asked, have you ever seen Hare Krishnas before? Do you know anything about Hare Krishnas? And they all say no. They're from all over the USA. They have never seen devotees before. Whether they're from cities or from rural areas, they have never seen devotees before. So that got me thinking, what's going on here? I remember during my early years trying to be a devotee in New York Temple, which is in Brooklyn at that time. What was the point that we heard all the time from New Yorkers? You guys are everywhere. There must be thousands of you. So now we have a situation in which all these American university students, they're doing foreign student exchange, whatever they call it, year abroad. And they don't know anything about Hare Krishna. Now, there's a difference with the British students from the UK. I asked them the same question. You know anything about Hare Krishna? You've seen Hare Krishna people before? Oh yes, of course. Unanimously, the British say, we know all about the Hare Krishnas. We've seen them. Yeah. Isn't that religion for the other people? Yeah, they've got that place, you know, George Harrison got that place outside of London. Yeah. For the other people, right? The British are subtle, you know. So, practically all of them say that. So what does this tell you? This was my lead-in when I spoke in Mayapur about ISKCON's first world crisis. We have been very expert at utilizing the low-hanging fruit. And that low-hanging fruit, without a doubt, is juicy. And it is sweet. It is auspicious. Our Indian congregation has saved so many temples, has made an extraordinary contribution to ISKCON. Leaders, resources. Nevertheless, the point I presented was that it's time to advance up the tree. We have full appreciation for the low-hanging fruit. But this is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and we have to consider how to service the whole population. Certainly in crunch time, you naturally focus on the low-hanging fruit. But perhaps it's time for us to extend our scope. And to extend our scope, or should we say re-extend our scope, we need to consider how to properly service a broader group of potential devotees, potential supporters. I quoted a statement by His Holiness Bhakti True Maharaj, and you have to see this statement in context, because some of you, when you first hear it, your eyebrows may raise. He tells his Indian followers, disciples, etc., you know, if you're just preaching to Indians, you're not preaching. He's trying to shake them up and point out that all glories to the low-hanging fruit, which is juicy and auspicious and fortunate. But nevertheless, if you're actually going to say that you're doing outreach, what about dealing with the whole population? So that's his way of motivating his disciples to widen their scope. What I am... humble service I'm trying to do is urban outreach, not simply in Australia and New Zealand, but wherever someone will listen. UK, I'm involved there, Toronto, Canada. I've come to Gainesville, to take shelter of this Grace Kalakanta Prabhu, who is doing magnificently. There's no work for me to do here, it's all play. I can just relax and soak up all the good vibes and... of course, I can predict one problem in going to his place. Where are the big donations? What's the use in preaching without that? No. I'm a critic, by the way, since we're at Alachua, I'll be frank. I'm a critic of the sannyasi, what I call sannyasi banquet circuit. Don't even know what the banquet circuit is, that term? It's a term from an industry perpetuated by retired politicians, retired sports stars. They go from hotel to hotel at these banquets, conferences, and they give a speech to rally the sales force of a corporation, to motivate the corporation's people. And they just go from one of those gatherings to the next. It's called the banquet circuit. After dinner talk. So I am a critic of our sannyasis, especially young sannyasis, locking into that routine of just going from congregation to congregation, giving a little talk at a house, at a temple, getting donations, and going to the next group, the next enclave. I don't accept that as sannyas, but that's another subject. I I'm happy to try to be a humble servant for glorious endeavors in Gainesville. And no, I don't expect big donations. I'm receiving the donation of a chance to render humble devotional service and see very glorious outreach. Nevertheless, we're talking about the first world. And if there were Kalakandabhu operations everywhere, you'd see a different country. We have these cities, you know. At this point in world history, over 50% of the human population lives in cities, like it or not. And that number is expected to only increase, barring environmental or nuclear disasters, by 2050. There'll be a great increase in human beings living in the city. So what is ISKCON's role in the city? Are we simply meant to have mundane buildings that come to life for 3 hours a week on Sunday, and the rest of the week they're just empty? Is that it? I like to recall letters that Srila Prabhupada sent out through his secretary in the 70s to point out how Srila Prabhupada was concerned with hospitality and the quality of the outreach. May I have some water, please? This is Chaitanya Bihar Prabhu. He was doing his medical studies in the UK, and then he decided to come to New Zealand to do his internship as a doctor, and then something happened. And he started living with the brahmacharis, which normally I don't allow. I don't allow persons just to live with the brahmacharis, because I don't want them to get an idea that that's the only way you can be a devotee. So usually if you want to be a brahmachari in situations that I have some jurisdiction, you have to really fight your way past me. And I'll try to convince you, no, you don't really know what you're getting into. You're not ready for it. What about your future life? What about your propensities? Do you really understand what it's all about? Anyway, he somehow convinced me to let him stay amongst the brahmacharis as he gradually became acclimated in bhakti. So then upon finishing his internship, he decided to enter the brahmachari ashram. And so now he's traveling with me on this trip through a few continents. So I just thought to introduce him. He is also part of the urban outreach. Let's get back to these communiques that Srila Prabhupada had his secretary send to show that he was concerned. Well, let's go back even further than that, to when the New Dwarka, Los Angeles Temple, was purchased. The building used to be a church. Many of you know that. And when the devotees purchased it, naturally they're going to refurbish the buildings. But Prabhupada told them, you know, the temple room now in New Dwarka, Prabhupada told them, don't take the church seats out. Leave the seats there. The temple room was somewhere else. Leave the church seats there so that people can come, sit down, and hear lectures comfortably. And indeed, Swami Swaminarayan Dharmaraj told me that Right after that property was purchased in the early 70s, he visited L.A. as a non-devotee, as a guest. And the church seats were still there. He sat and heard a lecture. And then he remembers Brahmananda Prabhu coming in front of the audience and saying, "Now that you've had something, some nectar for the ears, we'll go into this other room and have some nectar for the tongue." So for a while, they followed Prabhupada's instruction. But then, after a short time, they realized something. What did they realize? "We are Hare Krishnas, and that means all the action's on the floor." Hare Krishnas eat on the floor. They listen to lectures on the floor. They sleep on the floor. So out go all the chairs. Yes, Srila Prabhupada could be quite different from what many younger devotees today hear. And so far ahead, incisive. I'll give you another example before we move on. The first devotee who came to New Zealand, Tushta Krishna Prabhu, he came from Mumbai to New Zealand, and Prabhupada told him, "You are going to a first-class agricultural country, renowned all over the world for its milk products. When you get there, don't make a temple in the city. Get a farm and start Varnashram Dharma." Now, of course, what did devotees think after a while? They made some preliminary endeavor to get a farm, but after a while, what did they start thinking? "We're Hare Krishnas. We have to have a temple." That's what it's all about. If they had purchased a farm when Prabhupada said to, they would have been very nicely situated today. Now you cannot buy a farm in New Zealand. Only the Chinese can afford it. The land is so expensive because not only is it an agricultural paradise, but it's also a tourist paradise. So now you have a country where devotees love to farm, but they have no farm. And then we look at the USA, ISKCON USA, where there are quite a few farms, and our devotees don't want to do farm work. So, just see how far ahead in terms of vision is Srila Prabhupada. So, back to the communicants. The first one, he had his secretary sent out, was expressing concern about the Sunday feasts. Srila Prabhupada had the secretary dictate that, "I've observed the quality of the Sunday feasts declining." And then he specified that every Sunday feast had to have at least 13 preparations. And he listed the preparations. I mean, if you heard the list, you would start drooling. And that was supposed to be every Sunday, 13 preparations, from halva to melpura to sweet rice to chutney to sabjis and this to that, the other, 13. So he was on top of the scene. Concern with the quality of the outreach. Second communique was about guest reception. He wanted that every temple would keep in a Bay Marie type setup prasad for distributing to guests so that as soon as a guest would come, he would be served some prasad. Not that, "Oh, just sit down and wait, we'll go cook." No, he wanted it on hand throughout the day. And then he said, if there's anything left over in the evening, then the devotees can take it. This is proper guest reception. Then the third one is very interesting. I I don't know how many devotees remember it, but I was talking in Philadelphia with one devotee who actually remembered. And there, in that communication, through the secretary, Srila Prabhupada said, "We have enough temples." Now, this was like 1976. "We have enough temples. What we need now are what he called restaurants combined with reading rooms, places where people could come and receive nice prasad and then peruse our literature." So my take on that has been cafe with seminar rooms. And Srila Prabhupada was concerned how to create the ambience and the setting where persons could be introduced to bhakti, not simply a temple environment. So keep those points in mind and look at the situation we have today. Are we equipped to deal with the wider population? Do we have the facilities? Facilities mean something. How can we provide comfort for newcomers to hear about Krishna and gradually become aware of their attraction for Krishna? Or should we just say, "Well, look, if you can't make it, you can't make any steps toward Krishna by coming to the temple, then we don't worry about you"? How can we be more compassionate, especially looking at the situation in ISKCON's first world cities these days? We're not making an impact beyond the juicy, auspicious, and blessed low-hanging fruit. The Americans haven't seen devotees. The British have seen them, but think their temples are for the other people, not for us. What are we going to do? What I'm talking about is not so much about changing our language, changing our dress. I'm talking about compassion and sensitivity, as well as practicality in terms of what is our setup. One sincere devotee from the Chicago area contacted me and asked, "Western people, they come to our program sometime, but then they don't come back again." So I asked him, "Well, what do you got that they should come back for? And what should they come back to?" He said, "Oh, that's a good question." We just kind of assume that there is some cultural dynamic that will bring non-Indian persons to our gatherings, our temples. But there isn't. Now let's go back to before Second Avenue. I discussed this with Mukunda Maharaj. And you can get a glimpse of the situation in his book, Miracle on Second Avenue. You can also get a glimpse of it in Achyutananda Prabhu's book. So Mukunda Maharaj told me, in terms of the bhakti lounges, that I advocate for urban outreach, because practically every city lacks the ideal situation that you have for the Krishna house in Gainesville, which makes us all drool and envious. Mukunda Maharaj told me that before Second Avenue, Prabhupada was doing lounge or loft programs. He would have programs in artist lofts, and he would hold forth. He would just make some kirtan, his cartels, and then he would talk about bhakti philosophy interwoven with stories about India, but always quoting Shastra and always presenting Siddhanta, but dressing it up a bit with some stories about Indian culture. And then after he finished speaking, he would circulate amongst the audience, distributing finger food and making small talk with everyone. How are you doing? How is life going? In Srila Prabhupada's own words and diction, of course. So he was so aware of what his potential congregation was doing that when Mukunda Maharaj, in his beginning phase in bhakti, falsely was charged by police for marijuana dealing, and there was a little article in the New York Times. When the future Mukunda Maharaj showed up again to Prabhupada's gatherings, Prabhupada knew about it. Michael, what's going on? So Prabhupada was plugged in. And so gracious and so sensitive. Mukunda Maharaj told me that he was telling me, what you're doing is nothing new. This is what Prabhupada did before Second Advent. Sometimes Prabhupada disciples say that, you know, we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to go back to the Second Avenue phase and stop assuming that right now we are established, we are set up, and if the people don't come, they don't come. We have arrived. Maybe we haven't arrived. Maybe we have to go back to the beginning in terms of our non-Indian outreach. Maybe we need to reconsider what was that original attractiveness in the Second Avenue setting and before. Obviously, there was a lot of, in terms of early ISKCON, there was a lot of fanaticism and it wasn't all glory, but there was some attractiveness in terms of setup. And my point is that setup or facility is crucial. People like to hang out. That's why the cafe scene in so many countries is huge. People like ambience. Why can't we give them that? Just as Srila Prabhupada gave them that ambience in his loft programs. Why can't we have what Srila Prabhupada called a cafe type scene with a reading room or a seminar type scene where people can feel comfortable in coming by every evening? What I have intuited from my own tiny efforts at outreach is that those of you who came to bhakti in the 60s and 70s, congratulations. That was the Satya Yuga. If you only knew how the social fabric of the first world has deteriorated since then. So I gave some statistics in Mayapur. The U.S. government, I forget the exact agency, but it's the federal government, has determined that approximately 45% of the college students in the USA have at least one psychological disorder that requires professional treatment. And you know about how more than 50% of the children in the USA are not in homes where the original parents are there. Both original parents. 50%. And for ladies 30 years and under, more than 50% of their children are born outside of marriage. So what you have is what Srila Prabhupada predicted. A gradual disintegration of the Western social fabric. Now you go to the UK and the statistics are far worse. USA still has some veneer of religion. It's known in the other English-speaking countries as a religious country, where people actually go to church and identify with religion. In places like Western Europe, except for Italy, and UK, Australia, New Zealand, even you go across the border to Canada and the religious fervor takes a marked decline. So the UK is known as having the worst social statistics in all of Europe in terms of abuse of all types, lack of family cohesiveness, all kinds of disorders. But the USA still has that veneer. A big percentage of the population attends some kind of religious center and espouses some kind of religious affiliation. It's declining, though. I pointed out in my report the research of an esteemed Harvard sociologist of religion, and he did an extensive study over many years, and his statistics show that religion is definitely on the decline in the USA, especially amongst the young. But he pointed out that in order for the decline of religion in the USA to reach present UK levels, it will take 300 years. Of course, we want to specifically talk about the USA tonight, but I want to give you the global perspective. Briefly understand, in places like UK, Australia, New Zealand, Christianity died 50 years ago. It's not that the people are atheists, they just don't think about religion or God. Here you can talk about God and people don't look at you like you're crazy. You know, when I say here, I mean in the USA. So in any case, though, whether you say you are a believer in God or not, the social fabric is disintegrating. Just like you have the classic battle in the USA between the conservatives and the liberals. The conservatives, what do they say? Family values, family values. And what do the liberals say? Well, even if we want to espouse family values, guess what? Where's the family? So therefore, we might as well just face the facts and deal with reality. What's the point in beating your chest saying family values, when the family's disintegrating? So, of course, we leave the political wrangling to the political world, but the point is the social fabric in the first world is deteriorating rapidly, as Srila Prabhupada predicted, and this affects our outreach. Especially when so many of our senior devotees come from the 60s and 70s, which were, as I said, comparatively, those years were the Satya Yuga compared to now. So I've noticed that unconsciously our senior leaders, in my opinion, are shying away from outreach to the non-Indian public because you're going to be dealing with trauma, you're going to be dealing with all kinds of inner psychological complexities. And just compare that to the ease in dealing with the low-hanging fruit, the auspicious, blessed Indian congregation. As one temple president in North America told me, you know what is so great about just focusing on the Indian congregation? You don't have to feed them, you don't have to clothe them, you don't have to worry about their marriages, you don't have to do anything. Just be nice and collect the donations. What more could you want? And then you deal with, the Western population, and, oh boy, they don't know anything about how to keep a family together. Boys and girls, men and women just come together, you know, out of momentary attraction. They don't know how to raise children. The basics of civilization are gone. They have all kinds of psychological complexities, from abuse this way, abuse that way, neglect this way, neglect that way. So naturally, you would shy away from that. And then, if you do try to help them, the fear is, and sometimes the experience is, you try to help them, you try to uplift them, and then they stab you in the back, they internet you. Who wants to put up with that? It's very discouraging ordinarily. So for all these reasons, I've noticed that our senior devotees have shied away from outreach to non-Indian congregations. And we have a crisis now, a crisis in which I would say that we are far from adequately servicing the non-Indian public. That low-hanging fruit has done us so well. It's fortunate. It's auspicious. But Prabhupada wanted the whole tree. So how to advance up the tree from the low branches? First, we have to become aware of the problem. That was the advice given to me by the strategic planning team. First, give awareness that indeed we have a crisis. I gave you a window onto the crisis. So many students from the USA studying in New Zealand, and none of them know anything about Hare Krishna. I haven't met one in 10 years since this huge American student boom. I haven't met one who knows anything about Hare Krishna. They're from all over the country, from Bay Area, from New York. Let us speak of from, I even know someone from Montana. Yes. Nothing. And then to see the British, who know, yeah, we know all about them. We see them, we know all about their temples. We see their Harinam parties in London. But because London is the main city in the UK. The UK is 40 million people compared to the US is 300 million. And yeah, we know, but it's for the other people. This is a crisis. We need devotees who are willing to roll up their sleeves and try to service the Western public. We need to go back to the drawing board and look at, for example, what Srila Prabhupada did to get things going when he had no big palaces, palatial temples, so on and so forth. Basic hospitality, basic sensitivity, and facility. Facility means something. That's why you go to any major city, even smaller cities, you'll see the cafe scene is huge. People want to congregate somewhere. They want a nice atmosphere, good food, good camaraderie. Why can't we give them that? Of course, to give good food, meaning delicious prasad, we have to have cooks. But who knows how to cook anymore? The average young person these days does not cook in the first world. What they call cooking is you go to the supermarket, you get some pasta, and you get a can of tomato sauce. Throw it together. Cooking. They always tell me, I can cook. Swami, I can cook. That, at best, that's what it is. And most days, they simply go to a fast food place. So why not? Why can't they come to our places and get exquisite prasad, sit down in a nice ambient atmosphere, talk, make relationships with devotees, attend nice seminars, nice discussions where they sit on the couch, they're comfortable, and talk. You know, Americans, they like to do that, you know, just sit on a couch and watch TV together with a remote control in your hand and, you know, shoot the breeze and munch on something. It's the height of civilization. So why can't we give them that with Krishna in the center? But that takes devotees who are patient, compassionate, and who have the spiritual purity to bring people along. So again, I'm not talking about you have to change this and change that. I'm talking about the most important changes being compassion and sensitivity, patience and tolerance. And then you also have to be prepared how to help these persons, because you can't rely upon their coming from a stable culture. They're torn apart in most cases. The more you get to know them, the more you find that out. Remember, the U.S. government's own statistics about college students, 45% of them have at least one psychological disorder that requires, at least one, that requires professional treatment. So this is what we're dealing with right now. Again, the gradual disintegration of Western society. But we can't just ignore that and say, anyway, no need for us to get caught up in all that. And besides, we have our wonderful Indian congregation that provides the bucks. Jai Sri Krishna. That is well and good. That is glorious. But we need to get back into business again in terms of addressing the whole population. And I, as I said in Mayapur, I have to give full disclosure. I also do outreach amongst the Indian community. Yes, I go. You know that low hanging fruit is juicy. So, but at the same time, there's much more out there to be had, and it's our duty, not just to say in terms of, yes, we should be open to, we should be thinking about the Western world, we should be thinking about the non-Indian outreach, but what are we going to do? Radical, in my opinion, radical changes are not required. The main change is internal. And yeah, little cosmetic adjustments, but nothing that requires a massive revolution. Revolutions always sound glorious, though. We're going to change this. We're going to change that. All power to the people. It sounds very enthralling, but looking at Prabhupada's example, we see how he extended himself. I see the same spirit at the Krishna house. That same unassuming, humble spirit of serving the persons who come. Serving those who want to stay there. Constant mood of service. How can we make it so that you can be all that you want to be? How can we bring you along? You want to go one step at a time? One step every century, okay. You want to run? Okay, but how can we make your life possible. For the particular centers that I supervise, we've devised a mission statement years ago. We've been endeavoring like this for about over two decades now. And so a company culture has built up. The mission statement we've devised is, we make it easy. We make it easy, number one, to approach bhakti. We make it easy, number two, to organically grow in bhakti. And we make it easy, number three, to distribute bhakti to others. So that's our mission statement. We make it easy. Now, I have to admit, in terms of myself, I aspire to have a fixation for Srila Prabhupada's books. And so therefore, I quickly saw in this kind of approach an immediate benefit, that if I could introduce Prabhupada's books from the very beginning, like as soon as you start coming to the outreach center, you start to understand that it's about these books. And after a while, you realize, as a regular person who attends our club, our lounge, you should have a set of books. And then a little while later, you start realizing you should be helping to distribute these books. That's my own particular hang-up. So I found that these kind of arrangements are very conducive for that. In other words, you can build a company culture from the ground up, just as Prabhupada did on Second Avenue and before Second Avenue. And if you stick with it, your company culture manifests and sustains itself. Because those who came up in that company culture know how to pass that culture to others because they know it from inside out. And of course, I see the same thing in the Krishna house, the company culture, just perpetuating itself. So, the real question is, do we have the patience? Do we have the sensitivity? Are we willing to do what both Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada said? Are we willing to shed gallons of blood so that one person can come to Krishna house? Are we willing to do that? I'll tell you an interesting story from, it's a true story. Some of you may have heard it before. From one of our centers in New Zealand. We change the name maybe every 10 years in accordance with the trends that are happening in the city. Sometimes the place was called The Loft. Sometimes then it was called Gora Yoga. Now it's called Bhakti Lounge. We're like kind of, in terms of externals, we're like chameleons, you know, whatever gets them in the door. But our medicine is always the same. So there was about a 49 or 50 year old man who was attending. Our focus is mainly persons between the ages of 20 and 35, but an older person is not going to feel at all put off or discouraged. So he was about 49 or 50, he was coming every night. And after a couple of weeks of coming every night, he would just come and be quiet, attend the workshops, Bhagavad Gita workshops, and take prasad. And so then he said, after a couple of weeks, I'd like to meet who's in charge. So the devotees told him, well, he's coming next week. You can talk to him. So I came the next week. I gave a seminar, and then the gentleman approached me afterwards. And this is exactly how the conversation went. Hello. I'd like to tell you something. I've been coming here for 2 weeks, And I am so impressed by the hospitality of the staff, how caring they are, how sensitive they are, how considerate they are. I'm amazed. And then I found out they don't get a salary. That amazed me endlessly. Now, let me introduce myself. This is exactly how the conversation went. We're at like minute three in the conversation of someone I'd never seen before in my life. Now I'd like to introduce myself. I am a land developer. What do you want? What's your dream? I had to think real fast. Is this for real or what? So I said, well, you know, our founder, Acharya, he asked that we get a farm. And we didn't do that. And now farms cost millions upon millions of dollars. As I said, only the Chinese can afford them, and the New Zealand government's trying to at least temporarily pass laws so that the Chinese don't buy up all the farmland. So I said, even though our founder charged to get a farm, we don't have one, and now you know our situation here. You've been coming every day for 2 or 3 weeks. Our staff needs a place outside the city to rest, recharge, and we also would like a place outside the city for cultivating people. So we had this problem in terms of something outside the city. And he just stopped me and said, let me tell you something. Right now, you've got another problem. You've got $500,000 problem. What are you going to do with it? We're just sadhus, and you are a business person. You could help us by, it's very wonderful you're offering $500,000. You could find a suitable tract of land yourself, and that would be much more suitable than if we did it, because we don't have your business expertise. He said, okay, I can do that. He said, for now, we'll get you a place outside the city. In the future, we'll deal with the farm. But for now, this is what I can do. I said, okay, we accept that, you know. So I was wondering, is he really going to come through? Indeed, he went and found a place, and he used all his land developer chiseling skills to lock the owner into a year contract in which the owner couldn't back out, couldn't raise the price, but we could back out. And so, after some deliberation, we accepted the place. Since Kosha Rupa Devi is here, I'll explain. It's in that same area where you were. It's just another 10 minutes up the road, stunningly beautiful with ocean views and mountain views. And remember where you were?
Yeah.
For the retreat? Yeah, it's just 10 minutes further up the road. You can look out, you see the ocean, you see mountains, there's no one around. It's stunning. So he got for us a 24-acre nature retreat. You know, with all the New Zealand views that you see, those of you who go to the movies, you see in Lord of the Rings and Hobbit. I know none of you have ever seen. So, I think, I'm trying to remember. Yadubar Prabhu was there before we put up the Kirtan Hall, I believe. You didn't see the Kirtan Hall, have you? Yes. So Yadubar Prabhu and Vishakha Devi have been there. Lakshmi Devi, have you been? Yes, yeah. Was the Kirtan Hall there then? All right, so my point is, there's certainly more costly projects in ISKCON, and there have been bigger donations, but this was just quite dramatic. How to go from nothing to something in in a few minutes. And the man gave his reasons why he's making the donation. I am impressed by the staff, their selflessness, their hospitality, their sensitivity. And then I find out they don't get paid. What kind of organization is this? This is an organization I want to support. It turned out he was a political conservative, and he was very concerned that the government is doing nothing to train up character in the citizens. They're all getting social welfare money, and they have no individual incentive. Whatever. We didn't question his political beliefs. So he saw that, look at what's going on here. This is what the whole country should be like. And he is not a bhakti practitioner. He's not a devotee. All he is a vegetarian most of the time. So I gave that as an example of what can happen if you steadily apply yourself to this Western outreach. And it can be demanding, it can be grueling. Now, in my explaining all this, please keep in mind that I realize you have this glorious project in Gainesville which exemplifies this determination, this compassion. But I'm speaking about all the first world. We do have spots of light here, there. You know, there's Gainesville, there's San Diego. Such situations should not be the exceptions. They should be the general rule. Now it's time for a horror story. I told this in Mayapur, and there were groans in the audience. I have a youngest brother, 11 years younger than me, and he had an experience. So my youngest brother, he, unlike me, he grew up in Michigan, not in New York, and he was attending Kalamazoo College in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's kind of a snooty liberal arts college. And he was on the college debate team. And he entered as a debater nationwide competition, just like you had the NCAA basketball championships and football, you know, ratings, who's number one, you know, go Gators and all that. He was a debater and entered the nationwide debate competition. He came out number one in the USA. So Harvard Law School called him up and said, how much money do you need to attend Harvard Law? So he went to Harvard Law, and while there, he didn't tell me this at all. He was studying ISKCON court cases. Any ISKCON case he could find. His goal was, I found this out 5 years later, his goal was that he wanted to be ISKCON's lawyer. He figured, my brother's into this, I don't know about the theology, I don't know about all those spiritual practices, but this looks cool. Rather than my becoming just a corporate hack, I can, you know, be a lawyer in something that's so exciting. Trend setting, precedent setting. So after a year of his specializing in ISKCON cases, he walks over from Cambridge to the Boston Temple, our Boston Temple, knocks on the door, and who we think was the vice president or the treasurer answers the door, yes, and he introduces himself. My name is such and such. I'm a Harvard Law student. I've been specializing in ISKCON court cases. I'd like to know if I can offer some legal help. Nope, we have our own lawyer. Didn't even invite him in. Yeah. was shattered. He just couldn't make heads or tails of the situation. So he graduated from Harvard Law. He married his wife's from Harvard Law also. And first he became assistant U.S. attorney under Rudolph Giuliani in the Financial District of New York. And now he's the general counsel of Toyota, and he advises the board, the Toyota board. If you've heard about the $1.2 billion fine that Toyota has to pay the federal government, he was the one who was negotiating all that. Of course, bear in mind that, yes, the fine is the highest in U.S. corporate history, but Toyota has $60 billion in cold cash reserves. So you can read in the New York Times, my brother just making a diplomatic statement, it was very difficult for us to come to this agreement, but we're glad that we're past it all now. Meanwhile, you know, the $60 billion in cold cash, you know, give him $1.2 billion. Anyway, he wanted to serve ISCON, but because he wasn't properly received, I don't know if he'll rebound in this lifetime. So that just shows you the potential we're losing because we're not set up properly. So tonight I'm just trying to introduce the need for a change. Certainly, my particular approach is not the only approach. Those who are trying it and sticking to it, they're doing nicely. And it's hard work, and you get a lot of realizations. Somehow that we need our Western outreach to become serious and understand that we have to work with these candidates on a day-to-day level. That's another point. Back in the Satyayuga in the 60s and 70s, in my opinion, just coming once a week to a Sunday feast was enough. But today, with the mass weapons of distraction, with the mind so agitated with the disintegration of the social fabric, I don't feel that once a week, coming to a Sunday feast once a week is sufficient. The rule of thumb I operate by is 3 times a week minimum, and then you start seeing some progress. Otherwise, they come once a week, and then they go to wherever they stay, and their mind's just besieged, and their life is so out of control. Or if they're working, the pressures of the working world are so intense these days that they don't get enough exposure to devotees for bringing them along. And the way the population is now in terms of their mindsets, it's not that you can just do a quick hit, surrender right now. It's just not happening. So I say all that to emphasize we need to set up for cultivation in the cities. I'm particularly speaking about cities. We can't neglect the cities of the first world and their population. But we have to be set up properly. But as long as we're so temple-centric, you're going to see situations in which we have these grand buildings that come to life 3 hours a week. Buildings worth multi-million dollars. But 3 hours a week, they're jumping, and then the rest of the week, empty and cold. So I think we need to rethink our strategies and our situations. So I think I'll stop there. Obviously, a lot of what I said is my opinion, but they asked me to, blame it on the authorities here. I hope what I said had some value and some meaning. Thank you very much. I'm supposed to take questions? All right, we'll take a few. Yes?
I'm wondering, in light of what you're saying, so the selling of the New York temple, do you have an opinion about that?
Nothing curious. That I'll say.
Okay.
His Holiness Jayadwaita Maharaj is there. Feel free to approach him.
Okay. Also, Maharaj did...
Okay, let's see if someone else has a question.
Sure.
Anyone else have a question? Yeah?
I have an opinion, just quickly, that the reason that the British know more about who the Hare Krishnas are is a singular reason, and that is that the Soho Temple, every day, for years, have been going out on Harinam. And that is my opinion, and if we want people around the world to know who the Hare Krishnas are, go out on Harinam as much as possible.
Hare.
Thank you, Swami.
Hare. Any other? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So, in your opinion, what is the difference between our plans for Krishna consciousness and Krishna's divine plan for Krishna consciousness?
I don't really know what you mean about our plans.
Like, you know the leaders of ISKCON, you know the leaders of GBC. Like,
oh, those guys.
I don't know
anything about them. Yeah, those guys.
Yeah, those guys. I mean, Krishna, he creates multiple universes. He destroys infinite universes. He's unlimitedly powerful. Why are we struggling to spread Krishna consciousness, his own very movement?
We need persons like you.
I'm
youthful vigor and vision. Any other questions? Yes.
Kind of a problem.
Yes, that's what I've been told by our illustrious strategic planning team network. What is it now?
Network. You like network.
Yeah, I like network.
And yes. It seems that these problems have to be solved very locally, all over the planet.
I'm particularly focusing on the first world. You know, ISKCON is doing pretty good in the third world and the second world. Second world means like Russia, Ukraine. Ukraine Festival, as I pointed out, 13,000 devotees show up. Some of them, maybe 4,000 came from Russia, but still, you know, gather 13,000 devotees in one place. So that's the second world. And the third world, in many countries like Burma, ISKCON is very successful. And what to speak of India? I guess you classify India these days as second world and through the roof. So, but first world, you look at Western Europe, you look at other places, it's tough. So I call it a crisis, ISKCON crisis in the first world. And remember, Prabhupada's ISKCON started where? In the first world. Yes?
Yeah. I just read that Prabhupada said there should be 100 new Vrindavans in North America. To my mind, that's the direction. I mean, you talk about the cities, but the problem is cities. Prabhupada himself said this, that you need to get out of the cities and into these rural communities, right?
That's another lecture for me. Remember, I'm supposed to be GBC for Gita Nagari, so I can get on that horse. that's the other side of the coin. I'm totally into the urban-rural connection, but you know, we have a limited amount of time tonight. Okay.
Yeah, it's a big topic. All right, we can talk later, perhaps.
Yes.
Moved into the Brahmachari ashram. And I know when I was in New Zealand, I spent some time with the girls in the ashram, and we went to that retreat place. We had some classes and stuff. So there seems to be a full circle that you, like you said, someone wants to walk, someone wants to take 50 years, someone wants to run. But however they get there, or whether they get there, there's a place to get. You know, they have the Brahmachari ashram, the Brahmacharini ashram. I know a lot of your girls, and I just met them in
some Nepal. Some of them. It's actually much bigger than since right. then, and much more variegated.
Uh huh. So, but there's options. You
more
know?
Now than ever. I think you were there how long ago?
Oh, it was a while, maybe 5 years, 6 years.
Yeah,
I don't
we
know.
Try to keep moving.
Yeah. So, but what I'm saying is, I see it as a circle, or there's options along the circumference, and it seems like very often we get stuck in one place and we don't come up with all the options. So I'm wondering how we can, you know, have the outreach and then all the options so that people can go the full gamut wherever they're going to go.
Oh, that requires another discussion. But you see, my little self is known for the bhakti lounges, but an integral part of the program is what I call the contemporary Vedic ashrams, in which they're quite similar to what His Grace Kalakanta Prabhu is doing. And we've been doing this for 20 years. We have residences for both men and women, not living together, but where they can live under the supervision of an older devotee and have independence. They can work, they can go to school, they can get their health together, sort out their psychological complexities, all while being trained in Prabhupada's books and learning the basics of bhakti. And then after a while, they can decide, well, what kind of life do I want? Do I want to become a full-on ashram devotee? Do I want to be a brahmachari? Do I want to get married? Do I just want to be single and work and whatever? So that contemporary Vedic ashram, I call it that, we've been doing that for 2 decades. That is actually the heart and soul of the operation. So you get some household or couple who don't want to have children, or children are grown up or whatever, and they run the whole thing. Many of those you saw when you visited, they're still doing that. And once they get a taste for outreach and guiding devotees, it's hard to forget. And we've diversified our facilities so that we have, you mentioned ladies. Some ladies live in an ashram situation. Many live in apartments around and just kind of, you know, do their thing, but come in the evening to offer some service. And for the men, we also have these situations. And I require any man who wants to join the Brahmachari ashram first has to do at least a year and a half in what I call this contemporary Vedic ashram, so that they know what is expected of them if they enter the Brahmachari ashram. And they are doing it in full consciousness, their voluntary choice. So, yes, having an assortment pack available so that no one feels constricted and forced in their options, restrained in their options, I think is very important. And Kalakanta Prabhu has been, and Brahmatirtha Prabhu have been emphasizing that also. They've been discussing with me that they don't want anyone to feel pigeonholed.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. I'm wondering, maybe selfishly, how does one doing that type of preaching give association but not take on the association?
That requires spiritual strength and guidance. We emphasize the point that bhakti inherently means guidance. no matter what your lifestyle options are, you should have some guidance, you should have some mentoring. Yes, if someone just wants to do their own thing and visit the centers, of course we allow that. But at the same time, we try to make a culture of guidance. And that is where the strength comes from, participating in a culture of guidance. I don't want to go too late. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm curious if you, because you do travel to the U.S. often enough, if you were to head up such a master plan or a blueprint for the U.S., what that might look like?
You know, one has to work with the situations according to their capacities and their qualifications. I give advice in San Diego, for example. I give advice to, you know, whatever fledgling attempts are here and there. You know, I'm not directly involved in North American ISKCON organizations other than Geeta Nagari. And I give advice in Toronto, Canada. So, I feel that I'm doing what I can do, but if you think I should do more, what can I say?
When we were there in Auckland, I had asked Mukunda Maharaj, because I was so impressed and inspired by the LOFT program, and I asked Mukunda Maharaj if he thought we could take that blueprint and duplicate it in the U.S. And he thought about it, and his response was, he said, Americans are much more complicated.
New Zealanders are easy. They're more individualistic, believe it or not, than Americans. Television didn't come to New Zealand until 1967. So the Brahmatirtha was just telling me the other day, he's noticed. He said, why are these people so intelligent? And then he realized they didn't have TV until recently. Now, of course, there's heaps of American movies and television, and you know, everyone's brains are destroyed. But anyway. So it's not like, you know, they're simple-minded and just, you know, bhakti ki jai. They're more independent than Americans. And zero religious sentiment. Jesus who? And by the way, it's rated by the UN as being the number one country in the world for environmental consciousness and female power. Remember that story I told you when you came there? How I said to the leader, administrator of the ladies' ashram there, for the fully engaged ladies, you know, there was a catering event in town. You guys you didn't do it. Why didn't you let the men's ashram do the catering event? And so the young lady looks at me and says, Guru Maharaj, you surely understand. They're men. They're spaced out. You know that. They can't get it together. You know that, right? I mean, it's like reverse bias. I said, oh my goodness. With a straight face, she said, man, you know, spaced out. Incompetent, they can't get it together. So every country in the world has its challenges. There was a while when I was giving classes and so many devotees were there, I had to tell the ladies, can you please just move a little away from the front so the men can also have a chance to hear? We want to hear Bhagavatam. If they want to be, you know, what they're going to be, so what? We want to hear. I said, okay, but can you give them an equal chance? All right, last question. We got to go.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. It's really, really inspiring. Yeah. And all the facts and numbers, you know. What about, for example, Namahata programs? Like, I think that if we open, like in Satya Yuga, when you became devotee, in those days, devotees used to preach. There were a lot of brahmacharis, but right now, in Kali Yuga, most of us were grihastras. So,
especially because there's practically no brahmachari ashrams in the USA, naturally.
Exactly. So I'm just thinking that if the love and the care and the attention that you talk about, if we just open our home, each grihastha open the house to people and give them that will make a big change in the Western.
Any effort would make a big change, but bear in mind you're dealing with big cities, and people are not so keen to just visit someone's home, but they are keen to go to a cafe-type scene and get nice food, nice camaraderie, nice music, nice seminars. That they are keen to do, and they will pay for that. So I thank you all for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.